Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, April 20th. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me on the line from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. And good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette, and we'll speak with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner. Now, we'll look at some of the news here on the Cape and the Islands. Last Thursday, a little over a week ago, Yarmouth police officer Sean Gannon was killed while serving a warrant in Marston's Mills. Last week on the roundup, we talked about what we knew then about the circumstances. Since then, the story has really grown, and we found out a lot about Sean Gannon himself. And there was the wake and the funeral this week, which brought hundreds, if not thousands, of police officers and many from the community and across the Cape. Let's start off, Patrick, with an article by Sean Driscoll that really captures some of who Sean Gannon was and his wife, Dara, and shines some light on why so many have been touched by this tragedy.
Yeah, this story was really about them as a couple. They were a couple that a lot of people knew, as Sean Driscoll has said several times. If you didn't know one of them, you knew the other. Sean Gannon, obviously, through his police work and through his ties to the community, he was a local volunteer with Big Brothers, Big Sisters, and then worked, again, within schools. He had his police canine dogs that he would, I believe, bring to schools and demonstrate for students and other community members how that work was done. And then his wife, Dara, who is basically a rising star within the nonprofit world here on the Cape, and works with the Cape Cod Foundation. And Sean Driscoll, in this story, talked to a lot of her colleagues and people who had worked with her, and they talked about how separately each of them in Sean Gannon's case, were people who had a enormous impact on the community. And then as a couple together, they were just very dynamic, and that impact was even larger. And again, they stood on their own. So each of them, again, has their own things that were going on. And certainly Dara, I'm sure, will continue in the work that she's done. But we talked to Sean, talked to various people with the Cape Cod Technology Council, people with Cape Cod Young Professionals. She sat on a committee there and was really somebody who was really a proponent for supporting young professionals here on Cape Cod. And then kind of the larger nonprofit community where these interactions take place at events and on a regular basis, where people would just meet them and again expressed obviously their sorrow, but also how much of an impact they, in kind of the short time that they had been married, which was only a year or two, as a couple, were having on the area. And Dara, in her case, had only been here about 10 years. Sean Gannon was a native of New Bedford, but still had this enormous, again, impact, not to restate it, on the community where they lived.
On Tuesday, we had the wake for Sean Gannon. The governor was here, police officers from around the state. Give us a sense of what that scene was.
Yeah, and this was really, again, starting with the wake on Tuesday, two full days of public mourning. It started at Doan Beal and Ames Funeral Home in Hyannis, where now Sergeant Gannon's body, and it's important to point out that he was posthumously on Wednesday promoted to sergeant from officer, where his body was carried from the funeral home, put in a hearse, and taken through a procession that lasted for quite some time from Hyannis through the streets. People lined the streets. These are kind of regular residents coming out, community members standing along the streets. And I spoke to somebody who was out there, and they said that it was amazing that as the hearse passed, everything would just go silent, and you could hear a pin drop. And that was the respect that people were showing to this officer who had been gunned down in the line of duty. And that procession moved through the streets to St. Pius X Church in South Yarmouth, which is where the wake was taking place on Tuesday afternoon. It was scheduled from 4 to 8, but in reality, there were just so many people coming through to pay their respects. You mentioned the governor. There was the lieutenant governor, I believe, There were people from law enforcement from all over the place. The Boston police commissioner was there. The law enforcement as a whole staged at the Dennis Yarmuth Regional High School, and at about 5:15 or a little after 5, between 5 and 5:30, started marching down the street from the high school, which is about a third of a mile away, in these long lines. And again, we had many photos in our paper and up online showing this video, showing what just seemed like an endless line of police, and not just police, firefighters. There were people from the sheriff's office, from sheriff's offices, from other areas, people from other states, New Hampshire, you know, New York, you name it, who were marching down the street, marching to the funeral home to pay their respects. And even, you know, after our reporter, you know, had seen hundreds and more than 1,000, you know, certainly by our estimation of these law enforcement officials doing this, they were still coming. And, it, you know, that wake did not and did not end at 8 o'clock. It went on beyond that and could have gone on well into the night as people were continuing to pay their respects. So it was really an outpouring of respect at that wake. And again, this is, you know, the first stage, if you will, in this kind of public process of mourning.
And then the second stage, or the next stage anyway, that happened on the following day, Wednesday, is the funeral. Again, many, many people came out, even if they didn't attend the funeral, just to pay their respects, to be there.
Yes, and again, the presence of law enforcement was enormous, but the presence of community members along the streets and just coming out to the church and standing outside. The funeral was not open to everybody, and it wasn't broadcast per se, although they did pipe the audio from the funeral from inside, again, St. Pius X Church, where this was taking place in South Yarmouth. They piped it outside, and they also piped it into an overflow room where you could hear what was being talked about. And the focus here really on the day of the funeral was about Sean Gannon, you know, as a Christian, Sean Gannon, his faith. And there were some really interesting stories to come out. The Reverend Paul Karen, who's the pastor at St. Pius X Church, had actually known the family for quite a long time, apparently. He had come from the same area and had known the Gannon family for decades. And he told, you know, some stories. One, you know, he told a story in particular about how he had come to the Cape and come to St. Pius to become the pastor. And in June, only a few days after he took on that role, he was told by his office, he was called and told that the police were on their way. And it took a moment, and then there was a knock on the door, and it said, "Police, open up." And he kind of made this stern voice to imitate what he had heard. And when the door opened, it was Sean Gannon, and he came in and gave the pastor a big hug and said, "Welcome to Yarmouth." And he was just kind of messing around with him, but was also exhibiting what a lot of people have talked about with him, which was, you know, his humor, his goodwill, and his hospitality, and kind of he had gone out of his way to go and see the pastor and welcome him to the community, where Gannon had only really been an officer for a couple of years, but it's been somebody who had already made his mark and had already become an integral part of that community, and he was welcoming somebody else who he knew into that community. So there were a lot of moments like that, as you mentioned. You know, legislators and lawmakers, the governor and lieutenant governor came again. Obviously, local lawmakers were there, and the attorney general, Moore Healy, was present for the funeral. And then there were just people out on the streets who said that they felt like they had to come. There was one gentleman who said that he brought his 2-month-old son out of their house on Station Avenue, which is right there, to see what was going on, and said, "He's not going to remember this, but I'm going to be able to tell him that he saw this and tell him what this all meant." But again, police from all over the place, again, a show of support in marching down the street to the funeral. And in particular, there were police officials and law enforcement officials who had gone through something like this. And Massachusetts State Police Sergeant John Codfilia, his son John Jr., was a sheriff's deputy in Hillsborough County, Florida. Family has ties to Florida. John Jr. was a native of Falmouth, 30 years old. And in 2016, in March, he died as he was essentially, according to witnesses, trying to protect other people from a wrong-way driver down in Florida. That family went through, obviously, all this, the grieving and the community support that they enjoyed at that point. They were there again here to help the Yarmouth Police Department, the Gannon family, deal with what they're dealing with now. And also there was the an Auburn police officer and his sister was also present. I believe other members of their family. He had been killed in the line of duty, and she said that she felt that they needed to come out and, again, show the support that they had received at the time that her brother had died. So, again, it was the community, law enforcement, but also people who really, if anybody can, understand what the Gannon family is going through. There were people who had an idea of what that was because of tragedies that they had experienced, and they were part of law enforcement as well.
And your reporter, Jeff Spillane, had an article about the canine officers who turned out on Wednesday with their dogs and just a tremendous contingent of these folks to show their support.
Yeah, and again, another layer of community, and I've talked about this a lot, the different layers of community. We talked about the nonprofit. We talked about the community in general. We talked about the law enforcement community in general. And then there's the canine community, and this is a tight-knit group of people who train together. A lot of them know each other from across the state and across the region because they attend various trainings and certainly share and exchange ideas. Officer Gannon, then Sergeant Gannon, had his dog Nero with him when he was shot in Marston's Mills on April 12th, a week and a day ago today. And Nero was also shot. And on the day of the funeral, on the road leading to the cemetery, Chandler Gray Cemetery, which is right near the police station there in West Yarmouth, these officers, canine officers, came out and lined the street and their dogs with them. And talking to Jeff, who happens to be a dog person himself, he said, it was like a kennel in a lot of respects. During a lot of the day, they were standing there and the dogs were in the cars or brought out of the cars and, they were barking and things were going on. The thing that struck him and is just amazing is at the point where the hearse was being brought by, all of the dogs, as if on cue and certainly, as requested in some subtle way by their handlers, sat at attention and became quiet. Mm-hmm. He said it was an amazing scene to see and something that speaks to that bond between handler and their dog in cases like this. And that was really one of those things that's been talked about, the bond between, obviously, Sean Gannon and his dog Nero, who is recovering from wounds that he sustained on that day and has been released from the hospital, by the way. But these were other officers who shared that bond, and they were there with their dogs, and they all said, the ones that Jeff talked to, that they obviously felt even more strongly, if you could, they attend funerals for law enforcement officers, but in this case, because it was a canine officer, it meant even that much more.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. We're going to go to the break now. When we come back, we're going to speak with Sarah Brown at the Vineyard Gazette. There's more in a moment. This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. And with us on the phone right now is Sarah Brown of the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
Sarah, an iconic island figure has passed away, Greg Mayhew. You've got a nice piece on him. Tell us about who he was and some of what he did.
Yeah, he certainly did a lot. And he was, as you said, an iconic fisherman, Captain Gregory Mayhew, who, in addition to being mourned by his family and friends and as a community leader this week, he died April 11th, and he was 72. He had a chronic illness. He's also really being remembered as representing what's become a lost era of fishing on the Vineyard. He was a native islander. He worked the waters off the Vineyard his entire life, and he piloted, along with his brother Jonathan, two iconic fishing boats, the Draggers Unicorn and the Quitza Strider, which were kind of, twin symbols of the Menemsha fishing fleet back during the heyday of offshore commercial fishing often George's Bank. And Greg Mayhew was really at the forefront at that time in the 70s and 80s. This was a huge industry. And at one time, there were 25 commercial draggers and 10 swordfish boats fishing out of Menemsha. Today, there's just a handful, and we all know that there's been a decline in the industry. And in the summer, he would go out and he would fish for swordfish with his brothers, Jonathan and Skip. And Greg Mayhew's skills as a swordfish striker were legendary. He was said to be the best striker on the East Coast because, they'd go out there, and harpoon the swordfish. And then after the downturn of commercial fishing the last few years, Mr. Mayhew sold the Unicorn's ground fishing permit to the Nature Conservancy. Both boats are gone now, and for a lot of islanders, that departure meant the end of an era of fishing on the Vineyard that he was really a central part of. And beyond fishing, his father was a state representative for the islands, and he died in 1969, and Greg Mayhew stepped in to fill his father's term. He was only 24 and the youngest state legislator at the time, and he was reelected and served for about 3 years in the state house, but eventually said, politics wasn't his calling. He wanted to be on the sea. He wanted to be out fishing for swordfish and then also, doing all kinds of fishing during year-round. And he's also devoted to his family. He and his wife had 5 children that they raised in Chilmark right down the road from their family home. And he said at one point, you have to make a decision about whether or not you want to try to be the top dog in a field. And he said he'd rather be at home with his family. Mm-hmm. But he also really was successful in this industry and really, like I said, represented an era on the Vineyard that a lot of people are saying seems to be in the past.
And I thought the comments below the article from readers really spoke to the warmth of this man.
Absolutely, yeah. They really said, he was big-hearted, generous, devoted to the community. That he also, they said he had one person called him a beacon of light with his smile. And also, one comment that really struck me was there's a picture we have, a black and white picture of him and his brother talking by their boat, and someone said, that's something you might never see in Menemsha again, 2 brothers talking about their next trip out. But certainly, yeah, the comments get a glimpse at what he was, which is he was loved. He represents an era, but also was really known as a beloved member of the community in a lot of different ways.
Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Bye.
Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, the North Atlantic right whales are endangered. One female was found entangled recently, and researchers managed to help her in what sounds like quite a dramatic fashion.
Yes, and you don't necessarily think, okay, every single entanglement or disentanglement of an animal would warrant a full story. But in the case of the North Atlantic right whale, because there are so few and females are so important, in particular for the production of the species, it's a big deal. And this female in particular named Kleenex, and I'm not sure exactly where that name first comes from, but I'm going to guess a little bit that may have to do with some of the markings. She's an adult female. She was carrying rope wrapped around her jaw for at least 3 years. And this is the type of entanglement that researchers say is a major problem. It reduces their basically ability to reproduce and depletes their energy and makes it difficult for them to sustain a pregnancy and a year of nursing a calf. So they knew this whale from various spottings over the years. They even knew that she had 8 calves, last one born in 2009, 6 presumed to be alive. They knew that she had 9 grand children, if you will, grand calves. I'm not sure if that's a word. And then 6 great grandchildren beyond that. So they knew this whale well. And they were able to get out there after the report came in that she was out there and entangled. But because the line that was attached to it didn't have a trailing kind of line or rope attached, which is usually what they are able to grab a hold on to and start working with, they had to go in a different direction, which was using this kind of arrow that would help cut the line and start to accelerate the deterioration of the line so that it would eventually break off. And that's their hope. It's unclear at this point, for us at least, that that has happened. But in doing so, they said that their hope was the line would break free. she'd be able to swim more freely and survive. She wasn't in great condition, unfortunately. She was thin, according to the Center for Coastal Studies, which handles these types of disentanglements. So we'll see. We'll see how it goes. But again, out of a less than 450 or thereabouts of these animals that exist still, every single one that is saved, researchers say, is a big deal and could help the population survive and the species survive, really.
A count of homeless people on the Cape and Islands has revealed a significant increase over the previous year. What's going on here?
Yeah, and context is everything, especially in this case. Last year's count had shown the lowest number of homeless people on the Cape and Islands over the past 5 years, in the previous 5 years. This is a count that's done across the country, really. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development does this annual what's called a point-in-time account. It took place on January 30th. And again, various communities do it here. It's the Cape and Islands that it covers. And it showed 358 people who were considered homeless at the very point of that count. And again, it's important to note that this is a moving target. You know, you're talking about one night of the year that you're going out and counting people. That number could fluctuate throughout the year for various reasons. But they do use it as kind of a one way to judge what's going on out there. Last year, there were 324 people who were counted, and again, that was a low. But that 358 number is a 10% jump over that previous figure. So they do have some information about kind of where these people are. The number of people in shelters went, for example, from 64 men and women last year to 95 this year. So those are people who are in shelters, and there were 31 people counted in shelter who were in motels this year. That's compared to zero on the same night last year, and some of the folks that reporter Cindy McCormick talked to said a lot of this has to do with outreach and getting them into those shelters and motels on what was, I think, a pretty cold night, the night of the count. And that's actually a good sign that the outreach between police and social services agencies were able to find these people and get them into these hotels, and then they were counted there. So that's, potentially a good thing that they were in there. But again, they're always looking at what these numbers mean and trying to understand. It's not a complete picture of homelessness, as Laura Reckford from the Housing Assistance Corporation said. It didn't capture every person who's out there and who is homeless at this time of the count, but it does give them some understanding of what's going on.
In particular, they're concerned that it doesn't capture the unaccompanied youth, I guess.
Yeah, so. And that is one. These are again, young people, and some of them may be couch surfing. They may be living at the homes of friends. So again, you're not going from home to home to count these people. So they may be technically homeless. They don't have a home of their own, but they're, again, sleeping on somebody's couch, and it doesn't capture that. I know that there is an effort underway each year to try and find out how many young people are homeless. And obviously the goal is that they don't become older and remain homeless.
Let's speak now with Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Steve.
Ed, voters in Wellfleet got to hear from their candidates for the select board recently. I gather it was a lively discussion. Tell us what some of the issues are here and how this is shaping up.
Well, it was a lively discussion and kind of unusual one in its entertaining aspects. Wellfleet and Truro are coming up on town meeting this coming week and town elections to follow. And in Wellfleet, we've got two open seats on the five-member Board of Selectmen and five candidates running for those two seats. At the Candidates Forum, they revealed some pretty stark differences of opinion on some of the more controversial issues facing the town. One of them has to do with the location of a proposed medical marijuana dispensary on Route 6 in South Wellfleet, which the selectmen recently negotiated a host community agreement for, to the consternation of quite a few local residents. Three of the five selectman candidates were critical of the selectman's decision. One of them, David Rowell, said that that spot on Route 6 was a horrible location for a business that he said could attract 100 or 200 cars a day. He said, it's a left-hand turn onto Route 6, and if you're baked out of your mind, you ain't making it. This location, by the way, the company that has negotiated the agreement with the selectmen says that they are planning to go for a recreational pot license after that becomes possible. And one of the articles on the Wellfleet Town Meeting warrant has to do with establishing rules for recreational pot shops. So,
And Ed, David Rowell's son is also running as a candidate. Is that right?
Well, that's right. So David Rowell, who happens to be the building inspector in Provincetown, lives with his 21-year-old son, Walter. And Walter had a somewhat different take on the issue. He said he saw no need for having pot stores in town at all. He said, I've smoked pot for many years. I've never paid taxes on it, and I don't intend to start now. He said, it's a plant that grows from the ground. It's been in Wellfleet for many years. Some people here probably remember when it was washing up on the shore in bales. So why go into a store and buy it? If you smoke it, you already know how to get it. Two of the candidates, Helen Miranda Wilson and Tom Flynn, both thought that it was a fine location for a marijuana dispensary. So there's a kind of stark contrast there. And on a couple of other issues as well, the Herring River Restoration Project, which has been a major source of interest and controversy in town for some years, two of the candidates, Helen Wilson and Justina Carlson, said that they strongly supported the project, which is kind of gearing up to really get into operation soon. This involves us gradually opening the dike at Herring River on Chequesset Neck Road and restoring the tidal flow and the salt marshes behind that dike. But David Rowell said that he was skeptical about the project and said, we don't have enough answers to make a decision on it yet. That was yet just another one of the issues. That third one had to do with a residential tax exemption, which a number of towns, including Provincetown and Truro, have adopted, but Wellfleet has resisted. This is a tax break on property taxes for year-round residents, so it was quite a lively scene there, and it'll be interesting to see what happens in the election.
Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner. Ed, we don't have enough time right now, but I want to encourage folks to go to your website and read the story about Provincetown fishermen working together to fix the McMillan Pier, which is really a nice story, too. Ed, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Steve. It's always a pleasure.
Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times is with us. Patrick, the offshore wind company Vineyard Wind has been holding a series of public meetings this week about their proposal for turbines south of the Vineyard. What kinds of things did they hear?
Yeah, and this week in particular, they were in Hyannis and on Nantucket to listen to residents. The Nantucket meeting apparently didn't draw that big of a crowd, but there were about 100 people who came out in Hyannis to hear about their proposal. They want to build 400 to 800 megawatts of wind energy turbines that would produce that amount of energy, about 106 turbines, they're saying, off the coast of the Vineyard. This is Vineyard Wind. They're one of three companies that have won leases south of the Vineyard and are hoping to win contracts to sell their power into the electric grid. These are state contracts to sell to electric distributors here in the state. That decision is expected in the next couple weeks. In the meantime, they're moving forward with this permitting process through the federal government and through various other levels of government. These hearings in particular were to collect comment on their proposal as they start their construction and operations planning, essentially. That's part of a review that needs to be done, and they're expected to go through those comments and then come up with a kind of a draft plan and go from there and more comments are coming down in the fall. In any case, the people who came out talked about some of their concerns about the effect of these projects on the environment. They talked about the potential for jobs and the effects on commercial and recreational fishing. Interestingly enough, unlike Cape Wind, which obviously stirred for more than a decade controversy in terms of its location, a lot of the people who spoke at these hearings were saying, hey, this isn't Cape Wind. We're looking forward to offshore wind energy. There are concerns specifically in Yarmouth, I know, where residents are worried about the transmission cable coming ashore through Lewis Bay. And there are some hope. There's some hope that this project will prompt some more study of Lewis Bay, which a lot of people see as a fairly understudied water body that has a lot of impacts. The ferries coming back and forth from Hyannis. There's eelgrass there. There's fishing that goes on there, and people are saying this area needs to be studied more. It's in bad condition, and we need to try and help it. But in any case, again, most of the comments were questioning kind of what the impact would be, but also kind of delineating between this and Cape Wind in terms of their support for it. In some cases, there were people who did support Cape Wind who said, we had hoped that was going to happen. Now we're hoping that Vineyard Wind in this case happens. And again, there are two other companies, Bay State Wind and Deepwater Wind, who also have leases. They're not coming ashore here on the Cape with their transmission cables or don't have plans to do that. So kind of a little less of a in-your-face sort of thing going on there where they're looking at other areas and to come ashore, but they're all going to be in an area south of the Vineyard.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times, Patrick Cassidy. We're going to the break now, and we'll have more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. Patrick, the Brewster schoolteacher who is accused of sexually assaulting two first graders has been freed on bail.
You know, this is Noah Campbell Haley, and your listeners may remember he was arrested March 22nd after being accused of, again, sexually assaulting these students. He worked at Stony Brook Elementary School in Brewster, and I believe technically he may be on administrative leave right now. The case is obviously still ongoing. He was initially ordered held on $25,000 bail. And there was an effort by his attorney to have that reduced. It ended up being reduced to $10,000 bail, and he was released on that bail. He did appear in court again after that, and obviously was able to walk in and out without being shackled. He was a fifth-year technology teacher at the Stony Brook School, and again he was arrested after by Brewster police after three first graders told their parents that during weekly classes he would take them into this small room in the back, and then at least two of these students accused him of assaulting them. And so this case is going to be ongoing. It really struck a chord with the community and obviously parents out there. Who want more answers. Some of that may come out in any trial that goes forward. His next appearance is June 26th, a pretrial hearing, so we'll see what happens then. But he is out at this point.
If you've headed out to Fort Hill in the Cape Cod National Seashore, you've likely passed a whalebone archway, an artifact that was removed recently.
Yeah, these are jaw bones that sat in front of the Captain Edward Penniman House, which is a Cape Cod National Seashore-owned property. And Captain Penniman was a well-known whaler. He was a whaling captain who was one of the most successful captains in New England. He was based in New Bedford but retired to this home in Eastham at the age of 53 and lived there till his death in 1913. The property was eventually sold to the seashore. But these particular bones that were just removed were taken down because of concerns of danger, that they were deteriorating and could be a danger if somebody's walking and they fall, for example. I think that's kind of what they're most concerned about out there at the seashore. But a lot of interesting history here. These are the types of things that used to be put up in seaside communities. There was a place on Nantucket, Quidnet area, where apparently it was very popular to have them up there and none out there anymore. But these particular bones were from a finback whale, and they were there for 50 years. And they had been basically from a whale that had washed up, a large finback that had washed up on Jeremy Point in Wellfleet. And really some interesting aspects to this. There were two sets of jaw bones beforehand from a sperm whale when the house was first put in place, and then from a humpback after that. But this finback jaws, to clean them essentially.
What they had to do to get these ready, it was amazing, yeah.
They had to sink them in Salt Pond in East Ham for a few years and then bury them in an ant mound at former Cape Wellfleet for another couple of years before, in the fifth year, them being finally clean enough to put up. But even then, they still had some pieces on them, and that was one of the things that was happening as critters were getting in there and birds were living in them, etc. So a danger, the seashore said, and needed to be taken down. It's not clear what's going to happen next, but they're considering their options in terms of certainly replacing them, as a lot of people want to see happen, or building another gate there.
Mm. And meanwhile, the Cape Cod National Seashore has a new superintendent. His name is Brian Carlstrom. Change seems to be viewed as an opportunity for fresh discussion.
Yeah, and our reporter Marianne Bragg, who covers the seashore, talked to a lot of the towns town officials who are involved with the seashore, because their properties are contingent. They're in the seashore. Essentially, there are six towns like that. And a lot of these towns had a lot of ideas for what they wanted to see from this new superintendent. And in particular, communication was a high point for a lot of them. They want to be able to just talk to him and be able to share their concerns, share their ideas, and have that back and forth communication. He's been 30 years with the National Park Service, 10 years in management, and spent the last three in Washington working for the service. So he's got a lot of experience. Again, these towns have a lot of things they're looking to talk to him about: erosion, the use of land within the seashore, particularly in the Highland Light area where there's an old Air Force station, and then looking at, again, better communication. There's an advisory commission, and your listeners may remember that for a while the advisory commission for the seashore wasn't allowed to meet after the Trump administration started. They've now announced last week that they would be allowed to meet starting in June, but their charter is coming up too. So there's a lot of things that go with the seashore and go with the town's interaction with the seashore. And certainly a high on that is erosion and the effect on parking lots and some of the revenue streams that come from people going to the seashore and parking, and the towns benefit from that and also have concerns about some of the activity out there. So he's somebody who's certainly going to have his hands full and has a lot of people with a lot of ideas who I'm sure will be knocking on his door.
One of the things within the seashore in the North Truro Air Force Station is a collection of many buildings that are basically deteriorating, and folks are wondering what's going to happen with that. I know that's one of the issues that they're expecting him to be able to take on and help move forward.
Yeah, and there are concerns about asbestos and pesticide contamination at those buildings. There was about $1 million, $1.2 million spent in the last couple of years on demolishing some of the structures. And towns are looking at that area and saying, you know, asking about affordable housing. Could that be built in that location? There's already some things that go on there. There's a performance area, I believe it's Payomet, and a kiln on the grounds, as is the National Park Service's Atlantic Research and Learning Center. So there's activity there, but I think the towns look at that as a place where there's a lot of potential. It's a beautiful area and obviously has been used by the Air Force in the past, so you have to be careful about, again, more contamination or anything else that's out there. But towns are looking at that as one area where he might help them help their constituents.
Patrick, a Centerville church has attracted attention from some concerned citizens as it plans to add cell antennas to its church steeple. You have a nice headline here: cell antennas still getting bad reception.
Yeah, and again, this started almost after the fact. That the antennas are essentially installed in the steeple of this church, and it's not unusual these days to have a church go in this direction because it's these churches aren't making a ton of money. They're not big money makers, as people can imagine, but they have costs, and this is one way to basically pay for some of those costs, is by taking money from the service providers for cell phones, and people more and more these days are not on the landlines. They're using cell phones, so all the kind of connections that they can make, the better in terms of people getting service. But there are people around this church. It's the South Congregational Church in Centerville who said, we didn't know this was even happening, and they've formed this group, and they said that they're going to do whatever it takes to stop the antennas from being turned on within the tower. The church says, we've looked at studies. We've talked to people about this. These aren't going to cause a problem. They're not going to cause cancer as far as the studies, including from the American Cancer Society, I believe, indicate. So we don't think that it's going to be a problem. But obviously, people, their neighbors, feel differently and have even said that they may picket the church, which is hard to imagine in some cases. But they're raising all sorts of concerns. Again, it's important to point out, and one thing that the church has pointed out previously, I think, is a number of these antennas that are in the area already. I think within 4 miles of the church, there's 164 antennas. And these aren't necessarily the kind of large cell towers that people are thinking of. These are antennas that are placed in various locations. Some are placed on water towers. Some are placed in church steeples and the like. But the church, I think, would point to that and say, well, we're kind of one piece of this, but there's antennas everywhere. So if you're going to have a problem with us, you're going to have a problem with a lot of other people. We'll see how it turns out. The town says the church went through all the right hoops to get this done and didn't do anything wrong. The Concerned Citizens Group says they're working with a local attorney and considering their options.
And they are the Concerned Citizens Group says they're willing to try to raise the money equivalent to what the cell phone carrier would be paying the church to host these.
It's a passing the basket, if you will, and hoping that that will do it. We're coming up with other ideas to raise that money. But, you know, again, these churches are always looking for ways to raise money. This is something that once it's in, I think they would say, you know, it doesn't take a lot of work. You just collect the check. But, again, I think we'll see what happens. I think they're supposed to meet with the church officials as well privately to discuss what could happen going forward.
Now, Harwich voters are going to be taking a look at approving a pet crematory, and this would be operated by the town. Is that right?
Yeah, and that's pretty unusual. There are two pet cemeteries on the Cape, but this would be the only municipal one. This is on 2.25 acres on Queen Anne Road. It's right at the edge of basically an industrial area and then on the other side a residential area. Some people have raised concerns about the effect. The land, if you drive by it, has been cleared, and there's a gazebo in place in the middle, and there's supposed to be paths that go throughout. And that's the cemetery. And now voters at the May 7th town meeting will decide, if two-thirds of them approve it, whether or not to spend $578,000 to build essentially cemetery office and this crematory so that people could obviously have their pets cremated on site. There'd be another cost, about $92,000, for cremation equipment, tools, and training for about three people to work there. And again, the town says this will quickly start to make money. People spend a lot of money on their pets, and they certainly are spending money on the cremation of their pets and ways to remember them in a respectful way. They say they have to adhere to a lot of standards, including State Department of Environmental Protection standards in relation to emissions. And that they have to do it in a way that it's not going to be like a lot of smoke coming out of the area. It's got to be a light smoke, and they're going to burn off the gases in a secondary combustion unit. So they're saying it's going to be a low impact, and it's going to be a way to really start making money in the long run. But people really do have continued questions, and you know, one gentleman in particular asked the town, like, you know, what if your numbers are off and you're not going to do 364 cremations a year but only 200? You start to stretch out that time of profitability quite a number of years. So it'll all come down to town meeting and then town election beyond that, because when you're spending money like this, you have to do it at the ballot box as well.
And one of the Barnstable County commissioners has made a name for himself with his inflammatory posts on social media. Now there's a group of people calling for a recall provision that would allow a county commissioner to be removed.
Yeah, you and I may have spoken about Ron Beattie Jr. In the past. I think we have probably on a number of occasions. But Mr. Beattie has, you know, taken shots through social media, Twitter, at the Me Too movement, calling it nonsense. He went after one of the Parkland, Florida shooting victims or survivors, really, and has suggested culling great white sharks, which raised a lot of concerns with environmentalists and people who are lovers of sharks. And so he's developed a constituency of people who don't like him, essentially, it sounds like. And one of the questions that's come up repeatedly among this constituency is, how do we remove him from office? And, you know, whether you agree with him or not, when you look at that question, it goes to the county charter. And there is nothing within the county charter that allows for the removal of a county commissioner, as he is. This is the executive board for the county government, or if, for that matter, for an Assembly of Delegates member, who's the legislative body. They have 15 people, one for each town, essentially. And these two groups control about $28 million in a budget, $29 million for various services that are provided to the towns and citizens throughout the Cape. And again, he's somebody who was elected. He has a four-year term that goes through 2020. And when they're looking at ways to essentially put a recall provision into the charter, the assembly speaker says, this isn't as easy as everybody thinks it might be. We have to go through this process. It has to go to the state legislature, I believe. There was a proposal that was put forward by a couple of assembly of delegates or delegates themselves, and that kind of got shot down by an attorney with the state election division and the county legal counsel. So it really wasn't as straightforward as they thought it might be. And so they're kind of working through that process now. They're kind of going to come forward with something else. But the timing is tricky because to get it on the election ballot, the state ballot, they really have to get everything done by June 20th. And that's, again, to get it approved by the state legislature and to get it to the November ballot, which is where it has to be approved ultimately. So a lot of work still that has to be done here if they want to go in that direction. And certainly, you know, Mr. Beattie himself says that this is, you know, an attack on his ideas, that people just don't agree with him and they're going after him because of that. And, you know, the idea, generally speaking, is if you don't agree with an elected official's ideas, you vote him out of office. I think that's not soon enough for a lot of the people who are against him. And so they're looking for another angle. It may be that that charter provision may not be in place until after his next election anyway. So we'll see what happens there. Interesting enough, I think I heard that the charter itself has a subhead for recall, but then there's no language attached to it. So somebody way back when the charter was being put together, I think in the 80s, thought about it, but didn't think very hard about it, and it just didn't make it in there. And I think Mr. Beattie himself in the past, before he became a county commissioner, raised the question about why there isn't a recall provision in the charter. So some interesting back and forth there in terms of he was somebody who was looking at this himself.
And that next election where he would be standing is 2020.
Yeah, we've got what year is it right now, Steve? I lost track this week. It's 2018, so we've got a couple more years before that happens. If they don't get it done this year for the November election, you're then in 2019, and then it wouldn't really be in place until 2020. I think is the idea. So still got a long ways to go. And meanwhile, again, he's still battling back and forth with his critics, and they're still raising concerns about his use of social media and what he is saying on social media in different ways, and that's really where he makes his mark, if you will. At meetings, he's not somebody who's very confrontational in a lot of respects. It's just when you get to Twitter that he really kind of goes after different people and expresses his ideas. And you know, that's certainly a place where a lot of people express ideas that other people don't agree with. It's on social media.
That is our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest, Patrick Cassidy, from the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Steve.
And thank you to our other contributors. We heard from Sarah Brown at the Vineyard Gazette, and we spoke with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.